I was born in a small town called Masjid Suleiman in southern Iran.
I was born in Syria.
I was born in Hamburg, Germany.
I was born in Korea.
I was born in Tanzania in a refugee camp.
I was born in Singapore.
Guatemala. I'm from Ireland.
I was born in Thailand, refugee.
I was born in Mumbai.
I was born in Vientiane, Laos.
I was born in England.
I was born in Costa Rica.
Welcome to Many Roads to Here, bringing the voices of immigrants, refugees, and asylum seekers to a national conversation about migration and identity. I'm your host, Deegan Larkin. The Immigrant Story has been hosting live storytelling events in the Portland, Oregon area since 2019. Today, we bring you the second episode in our new series, The Immigrant Story Live, which features stories from the stage, stitched together by theme. Today, you'll hear from three storytellers who each found themselves, in one way or another, stuck, with no choice but to take a chance and find a way out. A quick note to our listeners, this episode contains discussions of suicidal ideation and descriptions of violence. Please take care of yourself and skip sections if needed. Our first story comes from Ghassan bin Hammam, who set off for a three-week vacation in 2015, only to get stranded thousands of miles away from his wife and kids, with no idea when he'd be able to return home. Ghassan told this story at the I Am an American Live Storytelling event in April of 2023 at the Patricia Reeser Center for the Arts in Beaverton, Oregon.
Everything was going according to plan. Had been accepted for grad school with a partial assistantship at The Ohio State University in 2004. My plan was to become a professor, come home to Yemen to teach. Before I left for the US, I get engaged. And in July 2006, I returned to Yemen for our wedding, 3-day celebration in our city with over 250 guests. We settled in Ohio, Columbus, Ohio, while I was working towards my PhD. My daughter was born 2007. My son was born a year and a half later. As part of my work and PhD in robotics, I worked with children with autism, and I began to notice possibly autistic behavior in our son. He was around 3 years old. When we had him tested, he was diagnosed as autistic. Muhammad's diagnosis changed our plan. Now we knew that we needed to stay in the US so he can get the support he needs. So, have to find a job at a US company that will sponsor me for an H-1 visa. The visa that will allow me to stay and work in the US. I found a job at Intel, and we moved to Beaverton, Oregon, in August 2013. Now, I focused all my energy towards the new plan that we have, the new future that we have planned. The US has given me top education, and I wanted to pay that investment back. I wanted to put my knowledge to work and make our company, Intel, and our new country, the US, the first in class, number one in the world. Faiza was in first grade. Muhammad was in kindergarten. Although Muhammad was doing well in Ohio in a special needs classroom, the Oregon school system was different. Here, he was diagnosed as not autistic, but just hyperactive. So, they placed him in regular kindergarten room, not in a special needs room. One day, a few weeks after the school started, I get a call at work. I heard the principal frankly saying, my son was missing. My wife and me rushed to school. We searched everywhere, the closet, playground, the busy street outside. It was a nightmare. Nightmare for all of us. For the school principal and teachers, for my wife, and for me. Finally, we found Muhammad hiding in a bathroom stall. Terrified in the new place, he ran out of the classroom into the restroom to hide from the scary people coming at him. He found a way to hide there by climbing up on the toilet so his feet wouldn't show. Smart. He stayed there, silent but afraid, and not knowing what else to do. When we find him at last, we knew that we have to find a different place where he would feel safe. At that moment, I was more certain than ever that we had to stay in the U.S. for Muhammad's sake. We did manage to have him in a better school situation. And the next winter, I decided to go to Yemen. I had been away for 6 years. I bought a return ticket, planning to come back in January 20, 2015, 3 weeks of vacation. Civil war had already started in Yemen in 2014, but my city, Sana'a, was calm when I arrived on January 1st. For Yemenis with H-1 visa, every time you travel outside the U.S., you have to apply for an H-1 re-entry visa, again, stamped on your passport. So I had an appointment on January 5th at the U.S. Embassy in Sana'a to get the visa. My interview went smoothly. In fact, the embassy official congratulated me for getting a job in the U.S. and being eligible for H-1 visa. And I paid the $160 fees, a sign of approval. But 2 weeks later, when I checked my phone to see my status, it was still AP, under administrative processing. In early February, I have to cancel my return flight in January 20, right? Early February, I still didn't have a visa. So I have to call my manager at Intel, explaining my situation. And we both agreed to place me in leave without pay, because I have used all my vacation time. Yes, I was aware. I was aware that I did not have a long employment history with them. Yeah. They could easily replace me. Yet, the only way for me and my family to remain in the U.S. is for me to get that job at Intel, to get that re-entry visa. I did not tell my wife. I did not tell her that I'm in leave without pay. She had enough to worry about. Running a household in a foreign country with two small kids, one of them with special needs. So I just told her to use my credit card to pay for everything she needed. For me, I started borrowing money from a couple of friends to keep my card paid off. Then, the evening of February 17, a friend of mine told me a shocking news. Ghassan, they closed the U.S. embassy, he said, and they burned all the documents. What? I could not believe such a thing could happen. All my official papers, my passport, my H-1 letter was inside that embassy. I could not believe the U.S. would destroy them. The first thing, the next morning, I went to the embassy. The door was locked. There was no one to answer my questions. 3 weeks later, the embassy did email me, confirming that they had destroyed all my documents, including my passport. I emailed them back, why? Why did it not contact me first, or at least send my documents to my U.S. address instead of destroying them? The answer was, this is an emergency. No questions asked. Finally, in March, I get a new passport. And I flew to Malaysia to reapply again for the H-1 visa at the embassy there. I went there hoping that I could work at the Intel branch in Kuala Lumpur in Malaysia while I was waiting for my visa before work from home. But that was not allowed. So I returned to Yemen. I did not know what to do. All I wanted was to be reunited with my family. I prayed to Allah, God, to show me the right path, and I waited. I would check my phone every hour, to see if my visa status has changed. Nothing ever happened on weekends, so I dreaded Saturday and Sundays, but in other days, I would check my status and my phone every single hour, day and night. It was always still AP, under administrative processing. I decided to mail my passport to a friend living in Malaysia so that if my visa was ready, he could get my passport quickly to the embassy to get their entry visa. The very next day, after I put my passport in the mail, they started bombing the airport in Sana'a. The plane with my passport never left for Malaysia. My friend never received it. My passport was lost again. One month later, the airport called, saying there were some personal documents had been found, and there were no guarantees. But if I wanted to come and check, I could try to find my passport. When I went there, I saw a room full of people and piles of papers spilling out of bags, stacked on the floor, like me. Everyone was frantic to find their documents. And I spent hours searching through them one by one. Finally, and luckily, I did find my passport. Then, full year passed without any change in my visa status. It was still AP, under administrative processing. In May 2016, I went to Amman, Jordan, to meet two FBI agents. They explained to me why my case is taking so long. The FBI has to get clearances from over a dozen of agencies before they pass on a visa request. And apparently, just one of those agencies had refused in my case. They were still working on it. But by that time, it had been 15 months that I had been without pay, supporting a family overseas through loans from friends. In November 2016, during the presidential election campaigns, many negative statements regarding foreigners, especially Muslims, were distributed. Around that time, my wife was officially informed. Sorry, we have tried everything. We cannot find a way to bring Ghassan back to the U.S. You have to find or you make life in a different country. When I heard that, I knew there's nothing I could do. So I started preparing myself to stay in Yemen and accept a teaching job there while keeping my family in the U.S. Even though I have given up hope, but I was still doing my hourly check on my phone. probably out of habit. But at 9 a.m. on December 7, 2016, I saw a new update. New update. Nothing. I contacted the embassy in Malaysia, and they said my case had cleared. Whew. Cleared. Only later did I find out my case had been resolved through a last-minute intervention from a Muslim advisor to the Obama. I immediately flew to Malaysia. And in January 2nd, 2017, 2 years, I got the visa to travel to the US. But policies towards Muslims around that time were changing by the hour. Even though I have all my documents and paper in order, in some arrival sites, the official might still refuse me entrance. Huh? So we decided to go with San Francisco. Because that was supposed to be the easiest, safest place to enter the US, right? When I arrived there, the customs official grilled me for over 4 hours. Finally, he handed me the passport, say, hopefully you will not get into this situation again. It was anticlimax, but I was far past caring about anything but getting home. It was January 7, 2017, more than 2 years since I have left. When I walked in the door of our home, my kids stared. They hardly knew me. They hardly knew their father. My daughter was 7. When I left, she was 9 as a girl, thinking what to wear to the school. My son was 5, now at 7. He hardly remembered how he and I used to play together and wrestle on the floor. I was in a daze, not even happy, just exhausted. A couple of days later, I went back to work. And I paid the tens of thousands of dollars I owe to friends who have helped me out. But other things were not so easy to fix. Those 2 years of living in limbo left scars, deep scars, in each of us. My wife had faced life as a single parent in a foreign country. My kids were growing up without me, there is no way. There's no way to get those precious years back.
Just 1 year after arriving home in the US, Ghassan received his green card. And he and his wife are now in the final stages of becoming U.S. citizens. Ghassan is able to travel freely to Yemen, and since 2018 has made the trip an annual event. Ghassan still works at Intel, and since returning to the U.S., is thrilled that he can watch his children thrive. His daughter has aspirations of entering the field of immigration law, and his son is flourishing both academically and socially. story, we'll hear from Rama Youssef, who escaped war and violence in Syria at age 12, only to find herself trapped in a different kind of nightmare when she came to the U.S. Rama performed this story in April of 2022 at the I Am My Story live event at First Congregational Church of Christ in Portland, Oregon. Please note, this story contains descriptions of violence.
I was in the seventh grade and had just walked to school early in the morning. It was the first class of the day, and I remember my science teacher explaining something on the board. Suddenly, there was a huge explosion right outside. It felt like something threw us on the ground, and even we kids knew war was starting. So at that moment, we thought our school was getting targeted. 2 minutes later, there was another explosion. The teacher yelled to get us under the ground and away from the windows. We weren't allowed to have our phones out, so we'd usually hide them in our bras. I pulled mine out and called my mom. She was crying, "I'm coming to get you. Bring any friends who need a ride." When my mom came, we ran to her car and piled in on top of each other. It was about six of us. I gave the other girls my phone so they can call their parents and let them know that they're alive. You can say I was born into conflict, but when I was born in Damascus, Syria, it was my parents' fourth try for a son after having three daughters. When my father came to the hospital and found out I was another girl, he went to the hallway and just bawled his eyes out. An imam came from the mosque, was just walking by, and saw my father wearing this long white thobe, a traditional tunic. He stood beside my father and asked sympathetically if anyone in the family had died. "No," my father said, "but I just had my fourth daughter." The imam chatted with him for about an hour and told him that girls can be blessings from God. Feeling ashamed and feeling better, my father rushed in to see me. He carried me, and he later said that day, "I feel like someone opened my heart, put Rama in it, and locked it." I became his favorite daughter. During the week, we lived in the city with our mom and went to school. But I really looked forward to the weekends when we would drive up to my dad's village, where he lived in his own house. And there, I would be the son he never had. I would help him in his clothing stores, and I would even dress up like a boy with pants, and my hair was always pulled back. But my mom said I would embarrass her if I dressed that way in the city. She insisted that I dress up, especially for Eid and other holidays. She also wanted me to get married like my sisters. I had actually watched all my sisters lose their freedom as soon as they turned 14. They would have to stop going out and would be quickly married off as young as 16 years old in arranged marriages. No education and no space to dream, I knew it would be my turn very soon. One day, my father asked me the big question, "When are you going to cover your hair like your sisters?" "I'm not ready," I answered, hoping he wouldn't insist. He never asked again, but by then, the war had closed in around us with bombs everywhere and our lives were destructed. One morning, my mom shook me awake. "Did you just hear this?" She had just heard a bomb go off and was afraid that explosions would be set near us. So we got quickly to her car to escape the danger, but all the roads were blocked off, and we had to pass where the explosion took off. Looking out the window, it had been a suicide bomb, and I saw pools of blood, even a whole hand just laying on the pavement. My mom shouted, "Close your eyes," but I didn't listen. It was too late. I had already seen those things, and it was the first time that I understood that I could die. Even though I'm still a child with no power to help myself, death can still happen to me. My parents were separated, which wasn't really typical in Syria, but they put up a united front to support their daughter's upcoming marriage arrangements. My dad lived in the high foothills with a view overstretching the orchards all the way to the Lebanese mountains. Usually at night, from our balcony, you can see the lights from the houses shine like someone had thrown glitter from the sky. One Friday night, when I was in the seventh grade, my mother was praying on the balcony, overlooking that peaceful view, and while I was swinging nearby, suddenly, the bullets went off, just like the movies. It kept coming closer and faster, but my mom would not stop praying. I shouted, "Stop praying, we need to go inside." She wouldn't listen. At least at the end, she did listen, and we rushed inside. I remember her calling my father to tell him not to come home that night because of his safety. It wasn't too cold, but I was freezing and very scared. I wore long pants, two sweaters, and was shivering all night. We drove back to the city the next day, and I never saw my village again. It was right around this time when the bomb near my school happened. And that's when my mom decided that we need to get you out of here. So she called my newly married sister in the United States and asked her to get us tourist visas. When my mom and I landed in San Diego the summer of 2012, it was such a relief to be away from the war and to be away from never knowing what would happen next. By the end of the summer, they enrolled me in school where I had to repeat the seventh grade again because my year had been interrupted. I didn't speak much English and didn't have any friends, so I would often eat lunch by myself. But that wasn't a problem because I thought I was going home one day. But because of family disagreements on how to handle things, my mom ended up having to leave me here while she went to be with my other sister in Egypt. And there, I lived with my oldest sister and her husband in San Diego. I felt like an outcast at home, just like I did at school. There was just so much conflict at home that my only way to be safe was to couch surf my friend's family every weekend until I finally moved out with them at the age of 14. But because my sister was my legal guardian, and when she and her husband had to move to Oregon, a social worker actually threatened me that she would deport me if I didn't go be with them. So I was stuck. It felt like the war had followed me to the United States. It had torn my family apart and left me here, alone, a child, with no parents to protect me. I came to Portland the summer of 2016, just right before my junior year of high school. And rather than just sit around at home and wait for school to start, I went downstairs and asked the nearby subway for a job. Through chatting with my subway manager at the time, I learned about De La Salle North Catholic High School, a private school that offers scholarships for people like me. Even though it was 9 months past their deadline to apply, I went there and talked to the president and told him my whole story, pouring my heart out. My mom left me here and I have to figure things on my own. He looked at me and said, "I would never let someone like you go." He enrolled me in their work-study program so I can pay for my own education, just like every other student at De La Salle. I usually sat in a little desk at my work-study program, where I usually sealed envelopes and just did work. And one day, suddenly, for no absolute reason, tears were just dropping down my cheeks nonstop. My supervisor peeked her head over and asked me if I wanted to grab lunch. When I told her my story over lunch, I realized that the trauma of my story was still haunting me. And that sharing my story out loud is part of my healing process, a process that I'm still going through to this day. At De La Salle, I met great friends, had amazing teachers, and even had a couple of helpful mentors. And by the start of my senior year, I stopped asking for permission to do anything. I decided that I was a child of war, I was a victim of a story I never signed up for, and my only ticket to escape my difficult past was education. So I did the research. I found a scholarship for people like me, Syrians that had been affected by the war globally. I got enrolled in college on a full tuition, and I was the first female in my whole family to attend college. Since I last saw my parents, I have grown about 9 inches. I got adopted into a loving family where I feel at home. Today, I'm a senior, graduating on the dean's list, and I just got signed with a modeling management. Is everything perfect in my life? Not really, but I'm still learning to live with that, and I'm still growing and making my own decisions. Last time I saw my parents, I was 12 years old, and my whole family is scattered around the world today. But I'm very hopeful to see them one day and reunite. And I'm also very happy with the person I am today. And I would never choose a different life. Thank you.
Rama's passion for education has never wavered. In 2022, she graduated from California Lutheran University with a degree in political science. She now lives in Los Angeles and is waiting to hear back about law school applications. Our final story today comes from Meghna Damani, who moved to the U.S. brimming with ambition, only to find herself suddenly and severely cut off from her dreams. Meghna told this story the same night as Ghassan at the I Am an American live event in April of 2023. Please note, this story contains descriptions of suicidal ideation.
Growing up in Mumbai, India, I was always surrounded by family, aunts, uncles, cousins. I knew I could always go to my grand aunt, Faiba, and she would tell me stories. She was married at 13 and widowed at 16. And according to our customs, she had to spend the rest of her life wearing a colorless white sari. She could not remarry, and she never really had a life of her own. One day, when I was around 11, I remember I bought her a cup of milk. And as she drank that glass of milk, I could see the empty look in her eyes. The very next day, she died. Something shifted for me that day. I realized that her entire life had been wasted. And I determined I would never let that happen to me. I didn't have too many people to share my feelings with, so I would write in my diary. I would go into my grandma's storeroom where there were these large steel bins of grains. I would sit on the white tiled floor, lean back against a bin, and write my heart out. The elders in the family, they were all worried about finances. That's when I realized that the person with financial independence is the person who has the power to make choices. The women in the family, my mom, my aunt, other women, they didn't have too many choices because they were all financially dependent on their husbands. But I wanted to be free. I determined I will never be financially dependent on anyone, and I will always support myself. So, I relentlessly pursued a career. I went to college, where my first job was writing for a newspaper. And then soon, I was even modeling for top brands like De Beers. Around that time, I also started dating someone special. I had a lot of fun modeling, meeting creative people, traveling all over India. And the best part is, I was making a lot of money, so I had a lot of freedom, and I didn't have to ask anyone for permission to do anything. At that time, Mumbai was coming of age. It was a bustling city, and I was in the midst of all of that. But I wanted more mental stimulation, so I decided to do my MBA in marketing, after which I got a job at J. Walter Thompson, an international advertising agency. And soon, I was working on their topmost client, Unilever. That was the best period of my life. At the time, I was still living with my parents, and my boyfriend at the time, he had come to the US to study for his MBA at Penn State University. And we had a beautiful bond, but we never really thought about getting married until our parents decided it's time. So before we knew it, we had this huge wedding. 1,000 people came, maybe more. And, you know, celebrations over 3 days. It was fun and food and laughter and dancing. And I had been growing my hair long for maybe a year, over a year, you know, to fit the ideal good girl bridal image. But the day after the wedding, I just chopped it all off till my ears because I wanted to be more true to myself, which is a bit more free-spirited and rebellious and adventurous. But my relatives, they were shocked. And the very next day, we left for our life in the U.S. In the U.S., my husband had just graduated from college and he had got a job working on an H-1. An H-1 is a visa that you get when an employer sponsors you for a job. So as a spouse, I got an H-4 dependent spouse visa. And my husband had told me that on an H-4, you won't be able to work unless you get an H-1. I didn't think it was such a big deal because I was confident with my work experience and all my credentials. It shouldn't be that much of a problem. Besides, I thought, this is America. This is the land of opportunity. So why should I be denied it? State College, Pennsylvania, was very snowy, very pretty, and very quiet when we arrived there in March. It was a stark contrast from the hustle and bustle of Mumbai City, where I had to even fight to have an independent thought. Here, it was so slow and so quiet, with not a soul in sight, that I could even hear my every single thought. Soon, the loneliness of small-town America began to overshadow its novelty. I would go to the library and sit there all by myself, studying for my GMAT. Whole days passed. I saw no one, and I did nothing. At that time, there was no Facebook calling or WhatsApp calling, so calling India was very expensive. In that small town, there were no jobs for me. I would cook, I would clean, I would do housework, wait for my husband to come home, which was the highlight of my day because he would bring me this amazing cheesecake. And I loved that cheesecake. I ate it every day, almost. And then when it was time to go to India and tried on all my clothes, I couldn't fit into any of my clothes. And my relatives, you know, they all made fun of me, telling me how fat I'd become. A year later, we moved to New Jersey, and I was really excited because now we were minutes away from Manhattan, where there were a lot of multinational companies, and I could get a job. So I started applying to nonprofits, advertising agencies, in journalism, in modeling. I even paid to have my academic records from India match the US system here. I updated my resume, removed any references for visa sponsorships. Even then, I rarely ever got a single response. On weekends, we would go out partying with my high school friends. And the men, they all had jobs. And the women, they had come here on student visas and they had got sponsorships, so they had jobs. And all they would do is talk about their jobs. Outwardly, I would put up a front, but inwardly, I was full of shame. I felt like an outsider, even amongst old friends. Monday morning, everyone we partied with, they would go to work, while I would sit alone in my apartment, staring out the window, feeling more alone than ever. The winter darkness was hard too. in our 5-story brownstone apartment, it would get very cold. And I remember I would go from room to room with a space heater to keep myself warm. We had no washer dryer in the apartment, so I had to go, you know, a block and a half to the public laundromat, 5 stories down, 5 stories up, putting the clothes in a bag, or carry them like Santa Claus. And then sometimes I would be so frustrated, I would just throw the bag down and kick it down the stairs. So frustrated. And then my parents and my friends and my family, they would tell me, why are you so ungrateful? You're married into a good family. Your husband is making good money. You don't have to work. We would love to have your life and live like you in America. And I would feel so full of guilt. I would feel like I'm not a good person because I want more when I already have so much. I'd feel a sense of shame, like I was a failure for wanting more out of life. Then one day, I found my dream job. It was a Madison Avenue job, and I met all the qualifications. And when it came to the question, the usual question on the applications, do you need sponsorship? I just left it blank. And I got an interview for that job. So I dressed very professionally, very carefully, took the train to Manhattan, had a fantastic interview. And the interviewer looked at me and she's like, excellent, I'm going to recommend you to the next level. But then I had to tell her, I need sponsorship. I told her, I'll pay for the lawyer's fees, I'll guide you through the entire process. But her face changed. I'm sorry, she said. We do not do sponsorships. It's a company policy. Somehow, I thanked her. I made my way out of that office, back to the train, to go home. I felt I had reached some kind of rock bottom. Here I was, qualified, and acknowledged to be qualified for the job that I most want, but I was powerless to get it. I thought about my grand aunt, the empty look on her eyes the day that she died. I had worked my whole life to not end up like her. And here I was, exactly like her, empty of hope. I did not see any reason to continue living my life that way. There was a CVS pharmacy few blocks from our apartment. I thought, I'm just going to get some pills and put an end to it all. Instead, I called some strangers. I called the suicide helpline. They talked me through it. They helped me understand the importance of my own needs. They helped me understand how my suicide would help others. Impact others. That evening, when my husband came home, I told him about the phone call. I told him, I want to be around friends. I want to be around family. I want to go back to India. And he was really supportive. I did not know if I wanted to stay married. I did not know if I wanted to come back to the US. So I went back to India and I stayed with my parents. My old company took me back. And it was so amazing to finally be able to use my brain, to be able to work, to have new friends. Then one day, on my colleague's computer, I saw these words. Nam myoho renge kyo. She told me that these words mean that we have the power in our life to overcome any difficulty we may face. And she introduced me to a worldwide Buddhist community called the Soka Gakkai International. And this community is the reason why I am alive today. They taught me that we all have sufferings in our life, which we call karma. But when we use our sufferings to help others, they become a source of strength and inspiration. So our karma becomes our mission. With their support, I found the courage to come back to the US and work things out with my husband. I also realized that I wanted to find my purpose in life, which was more than just getting a job. Gradually, I realized that my purpose is to tell my story, to help other women like me. Back in the US, I enrolled for a documentary filmmaking program at the New School in Manhattan, where I made my first documentary. It's an autobiographical documentary called Heart Suspended, which broke the silence around the plight of dependent spouse visa holders. The film premiered in 2007 at the New York Indian Film Festival in Manhattan. I walked the red carpet, and then soon the press started reaching out to me. And then universities reached out and they included the film in their courses. But most importantly, so many women reached out to me, telling me about the abuse and the exploitation that they faced because of the restrictions of the H-4 visa. I was part of a group that met with members of Congress. We shared our stories, I showed them my film, and they told us that they were shocked to see how their policies were impacting people. Finally, in 2015, President Obama issued an executive order granting work authorization to thousands of dependent spouse visa holders. This was unprecedented, and I felt that all my years of suffering were not wasted. Today, I am an American citizen. I have found my voice, and I'm using it to tell my story, to help many others like me. Because all it takes is just one person speaking up.
Magna continues to work on documentaries that create awareness and social impact around the struggles of immigrant women and children. You can check out her work by following her on Instagram at Meg Damani, that's MEGDAMANI, or visit her website at the link posted in the description of this episode. The Immigrant Story Live is a production of The Immigrant Story. This episode was produced by me, Deacon Larkin, with audio editing by Greg Palmer. Our executive producer is Sankar Raman. Original audio is from the 2023 I Am an American live event and the 2022 I Am My Story live event, both produced by The Immigrant Story. If you want to catch up on our past live events, don't forget to subscribe to our YouTube channel at The Immigrant Story Live. This episode is part of the I Am an American series, generously funded by Ann Nadel Campbell.